Tonight, in moving from a discussion of the yoga and the esoteric dimensions of Egypt to Mexico, I'd like to adopt the same method of giving you the translations of the original material and then just providing a kind of running commentary to it. It's fortunate now that the material that was translated from Nahuatl into Spanish and has been unavailable in English for some time is now available in English. And so you can, the translations I'll be using are by John Bierhorst. And there are two different versions or so that I'm going to be telling of the story of Quetzalcoatl. The mythology as we have it is basically coming through the Aztec. But the Aztecs looked upon Quetzalcoatl as an earlier god who once ruled supreme before he was challenged by the more militarist god Huitzilopochtli. And Quetzalcoatl was looked upon as a kind of benign god who refused to be involved with human sacrifice, but not a realistic god of the world and of the world as the Aztecs knew it. But the Aztecs were quite late, and they, when they came as Chichimecs from the north down into the south, passed by the ancient ruins of the Great Pyramid of the Sun in Teotihuacan and hadn't a clue of who lived there. And all they knew were of legends of the great Toltecs, who were masters of all the arts and who had the sacred and initiatic knowledge to build that great city, and had as one of their lords the great Quetzalcoatl. There are two images that go throughout Mexico that tend to correspond between the side of darkness and the side of good. You have Huitzilopochtli, the Aztec god of war and the sun, and then you have Quetzalcoatl. But also much earlier, you have the sense of the image of the jaguar as the image of the militarist class, and you have the serpent as the image of esoteric mysteries. Now, this presence of jaguar and serpent as almost totems for two different clans, groups, the order of the priests and the order of the warriors, seems to go back all the way to the Olmecs. And the Olmecs are the first historical civilized people of Mexico who come in mysteriously from no one knows where with a somewhat advanced technology, in the sense that they seem to have the ability to express agriculture and the calendar and some forms of metalwork and jewelry work, and these strange obsidian mirrors that they, concave mirrors that they wore on their chest and did various kinds of hocus pocus with, that I'll explain a little later. And they come into an area near Veracruz called San Lorenzo Tenochtitlan. And they seem to impress themselves upon the peasant villages and establish something like a theocracy or a military ruling class for about 400 or 500 years, until there seems to be remnants of a revolution in that the monuments are attacked and disfigured and abandoned. So there's a lot of mystery surrounding the Olmecs. Their language seems to be sort of proto-Maya. But the images as far back as 1200 BC in San Lorenzo Tenochtitlan show the images of the serpent and the jaguar. And in recent literature, there are suggestions that the serpent is the really ancient image of the religion. So this historical battle that we pick up with the Toltecs and the Aztecs, of the battle between the warriors and the priests, of the battle between the forces of the jaguar and the forces of the serpent, may go all the way back. Now, people historically know so very little about Mexico that they refer to all of Mexico as Aztec. And this would be like referring to Europe as American. The Aztecs are Johnny-come-latelys. They did not build the pyramids. Even a few weeks ago, they showed photographs from the back of the New York Times, and they showed a pyramid from Egypt, and then they showed a picture of the pyramid of Teotihuacan, and they called it Aztec. Well, Teotihuacan is not Aztec. It's about 800 years earlier than the Aztecs. So it's astonishing how ignorant we are about Mexico when we're sitting on top of really one of the great civilizations of the world. It's in astronomy and mathematics and architecture and gold work, in literature and mythology. It's every bit the equal of the classical civilizations of the world. And if you take into effect Maya astronomy and the fact that they had zero and placement mathematics and incredibly sophisticated astronomy, and the time at which they had it, they're more advanced than Charlemagne, and they're coeval with Charlemagne. So if you were to settle down in Europe in the year, say, 675 to 725, or 800, the date of Charlemagne, the civilization in Mexico would be superior to the civilization in Europe. And it's only because of our Eurocentric point of view and the fact that we came in on the coattails of Cortez that we've tended to ignore their achievements and say that they're heathens and they're pagans and their religion is idolatry and they deserve to be given smallpox and syphilis and everything else and enslaved. And so our appreciation of their culture has been really obscured by an incredibly arrogant imperialism. Once we abandon that point of view and take a look at the culture, it's amazingly advanced. And certainly the myth of Quetzalcoatl is one of the great stories of the world, and in its sense of poetry and tragedy has often been linked to the basic messianic pattern of Christ. So much so that probably, as you know, the Mormons claim that Quetzalcoatl was Christ in the New World, and they have constructed a whole elaborate mythological explanation of the relationship of the lost tribes of Israel and Mexico and things of that sort. But rather than get into the Mormon version, I'd rather start out with the pure Mexican version itself for tonight. So at any rate, the religion of Quetzalcoatl is earlier. And so when we see Quetzalcoatl through Aztec eyes, we're in the same danger that we were last week when we're looking at Isis and Osiris through the translations of Plutarch and looking at it through the incredibly cosmopolitan and syncretic culture of the Hellenistic period, trying to get at something that's much more ancient and antedates by thousands of years the world that Plutarch knew. So it's very much the same here. We have to piece back what is the original story, and it's like trying to reconstruct the Sermon on the Mount by the words of a Air Force chaplain blessing the bombers before they go off to Dresden for the firebombing, or a chaplain at work in South Vietnam before they go in to blow up the villages of the South Vietnamese. So that we were in such a period of contradiction that the original Christianity is barely recoverable in our own culture, and even much more difficult when we go into another culture and we try to really reconstruct what the religion of Quetzalcoatl would be. There are several different versions, and one has to sort of piece them together. And the difficulty with piecing things together is one tends to piece together what makes sense to you and to ignore what doesn't make much sense. And I'm certainly not going to be innocent of that sin of exegesis. But the other difficulty is that in a mythology where you've got fragments, you have basically a folk tradition that has many different variations of the birth of the hero and the death of the hero. Mythology is a kind of language in which there isn't a simple propositional statement that runs on logic. It's a metalogical or metaphysical system which is about contradictions and about transformations, and therefore there are always several different beginnings of the hero and several different endings, and you can't settle on one simple truth and put it down and say this is the true story of how Quetzalcoatl disappeared. So you have to embrace contradictions and simultaneities and many different versions, and at the same time try to sense what the original story must have been, because you're confronted with an artifact that is a fossil of several different cultures. And so sometimes in the codices they will interlard another story that's quite clearly an interruption in a later story and just tacked on. This often happens even in the West. The monks were known to tack on other stories or begin with a prayer and end with a prayer, and then in the middle of their prayer they would drop in this incredibly ancient story surrounded by a Christian frame. Things like the voyage of Bran in ancient Ireland is something like this. In the same sense of the materials of the Sumerian Gilgamesh, you've got many different Gilgamesh stories. Gilgamesh's descent into the underworld, Gilgamesh and the Hulupu tree, and then you've got the regular Akkadian Gilgamesh. So what happened with the Akkadian Semitic Gilgamesh is a court poet of the third dynasty of Ur put it all together and took the various folk tales and jest and put them together in one artistic work. We don't have such a work from Quetzalcoatl, though the recovery is stimulating new works in this direction. There's a novel by Miguel, I think León Portilla, on Quetzalcoatl, and of course there was the earlier version by D.H. Lawrence. So the myth has stimulated many different imaginations, but most of those are takeoffs of the individual artist just using the plumed serpent and trying to write another story. What we don't have is an indigenous artist taking the folk material and turning it into one coherent work, and that would be, in a sense, a marvel to have, but it's just not there. Nevertheless, what Bierhorst has done in translate going back to the Nahuatl and translating directly from the Nahuatl into English instead of from Nahuatl to Spanish to English is to try to restore it. And I think this does help to give us a sense of what the dimensions of the story are. So since there are sort of several Quetzalcoatls, perhaps maybe as many as four, I want to separate them out by beginning with the first Quetzalcoatl, who is in a sense the god of the of this sun or this world period. In the Mexican mythology, there are four previous suns or world epochs, and they are destroyed by cataclysm. The last cataclysm, the world was destroyed by flood, and this world cataclysm, according to the prophecies, will be destroyed by earthquake and fire and movement somewhere around the year 2011 AD, when the historical cycle comes to an end. And this historical cycle is from 3113 BC to 2011 AD, so that the date of the Maya calendar corresponds pretty much with the beginning of civilization in the Middle East and ends with the magical year 2000, except they have it in 2011 AD. So you have the world destroyed by flood, and you have the quietness of the world, and the gods are wondering and assembling who is going to live. The gods seem to, as you'll recall from the Sumerian, and you'll see next week when we get into the Babylonian, Enuma Elish, the gods are something like a gas that requires the matter of human beings, that they seem to feed on our energy the way we feed on animals or plants, or the way a fire will feed on a log. And gods are like a gaseous energy that is not totally independent of matter, and therefore these gods are vitally concerned with matter and vitally concerned with the goings-on of human beings, even at the same time that they're very punitive and are always wiping us out. You'll remember again last week from Gilgamesh, where the gods get sick and tired of the noise of man teemed upon the earth, and they long for quiet, and so they just wipe it out with a flood, except for saving Utnapishtim. So what we have in the beginning of the story is the wrath of the gods, the flood, and then beginning to wonder about what is going to be the reconstruction of the new historical period, what will be saved and what will be transformed. So I'll read now from the codices. And the gods assembled then, and they said, "Who shall live? The skies have dried, the earth, Lord, has dried, but who, O gods, shall live They were therefore troubled. Skirt of stars, light of day, Lord drawn to the water, Lord issuing forth. Notice how these are sort of much like the kennings and like the Homeric similes, so that some of the original quality of the language in the Nahuatl begins to come out much more when the translations are literal. That's the name of the great earth goddess Coatlicue, Skirt of Stars. Skirt of stars, light of day, Lord drawn to the water, Lord issuing forth, who firms the earth, who tills the earth, Quetzalcoatl, Titlacuahuan were their names. But Quetzalcoatl went to the dead land then, and came to the dead land lord, to the dead land lady, saying, these the precious bones in your keeping, for these I have come, and these I would take. Now notice how this is similar in structure to Inanna's descent into the netherworld, and she comes to the terrible goddess of the underworld, Ereshkigal. And so Quetzalcoatl, concerned that there is no continuity of life, wishes to dive down and achieve life by going back to the bones of those killed in the flood. And he was answered at once, to make what, Quetzalcoatl? And therefore he spoke again. The gods are troubled, asking, who shall live on earth? So this Quetzalcoatl is clearly not a man, but a god, and is one with the gods. And so he's to be distinguished with some of the later Quetzalcoatls who are historical figures. And so too the lord of the dead land spoke again, very well, blow my trumpet shell and circle four times round my emerald realm. But his trumpet shell was not hollow. Then Quetzalcoatl summoned worms who hollowed it out, and at once bees and hornets went in, and then he blew. And so there's a sense that in death there is a solidity, there is matter without the whole, there, and therefore lacks the vibration. And that the vibration of life is always a relationship of opposites. Krishna's flute, which is basically the spinal column, has the seven holes which allow the wind to go through it and allow the vibrations to come forth. And the vibrations of the seven holes are, of course, the seven chakras of Krishna's flute. You have also the sense in the Chinese Tao Te Ching, where it says the purpose of a cup comes from the part of the cup that is not there, that is hollow. So something that is absolutely solid and uniform lacks the proper wedding of opposites and therefore is incapable of life. And so to create life, he has to summon these sort of engineers of the animal world, these agencies of transformation, and he deals at once with bees and hornets, who both in transforming, say, wood into paper to make a house, or flowers into honey, another act of transformation, are also, in a sense, creating life, but themselves emitting a sound of vibration and a sound of life in the very act of their own working. And so too the Lord of the Dead Land spoke once more. Very well, take them. But then to his subjects, the Mixteca, the Lord of the Dead Land said, my holy ones, tell him he must but relinquish them. And so now there's the war of the opposites, the war of the Lord of the Underground who wants to keep the bones there, and Quetzalcoatl who has to somehow trick his way in and get them. So Quetzalcoatl begins here to be something of a trickster. And you'll recall that this quality of the trickster god, who in Greek would be Hermes, was something like Enki, who craftily was able to tell Utnapishtim, flee for your life, abandon your possessions and make a boat, there's a flood coming. And so Enlil wants to wipe everybody out, but Enki, the crafty god, is the one who somehow finds ways for human beings to survive the flood. So Quetzalcoatl here is functioning very much in the flood literature as Enki does in the other. And at once Quetzalcoatl said, but no, I have them already and forever. But his Nahual, now Nahual means, some of you may be familiar from this from Castaneda's last book, Nahual is your double, your ka in the Egyptian, or in the Greek sense it would be your daemon. It's your guardian spirit, it's your double, it's your opposite, it's your soul level talking to your personality level. There are many different mythological ways you can explain it. And so in Mexico it's called the Nahual. But his Nahual said to him, merely answer, I do but relinquish them. So the Nahual is the guardian spirit who gives you advice. They're like the voice of the conscience who helps you get through difficult situations. Quetzalcoatl spoke at once. He cried out, "I do but relinquish them." Yet in fact, he ascended with them. And so here he is, the trickster. It's an interesting aspect that the god is, in the sense, being amoral. Jung, in his analysis of the trickster figure or the Hermes figure, will often show how the morality of the unconscious is much larger than the morality of the ego. And the idea of a moral code or a societal form of rules or the bourgeois life is one thing, but the full morality of the unconscious or of the daemon is quite another. And sometimes when the ego touches the daemon, it's incomprehensible, and the power of the daemon is almost withering and overpowering to the ego, who tries to interpret, rationalize, and understand and codify. So Quetzalcoatl says, "I do but relinquish them," yet in fact he ascended with them. "Then truly he took up the precious bones, the bones of man where they lay to one side, and two, the bones of woman where they lay to one side. Quetzalcoatl took them at once, then he wrapped them up, then he carried them off. But the Lord of the Dead Land now spoke again to his subjects, 'Holy ones, Quetzalcoatl is truly removing the precious bones. Holy ones, make him a crypt.'" Notice how this is very much similar to, again, Set, the principle of evil and limitation, who locks Osiris into the coffin that is the body. "Make him a crypt." Then they made it for him. He was startled by quail, moreover, and so he fell into the crypt. So there's a cry of a bird, and he falls into the crypt, and he stumbled, he fell unconscious. And remember last week I talked about the initiatic process by which you lie down into the sarcophagus, and there's the sarcophagus in the central chamber of the Great Pyramid, and then you put your body into suspended animation and then leave into an altered state of consciousness, or going into out-of-the-body travel. And there, in the other dimensions of the collective unconsciousness, you fight all the demons and beasts of the unconscious. So now, in a sense, the war for the survival of humanity and the war between the gods of light and darkness are being carried out in other dimensions. But he's unable to carry the bones up, and a cry of the bird numbs him and puts him unconscious. And so human beings are not going to be immortal. In all of these etiological stories, there's generally a story of how is it the case that human beings are not immortal? How did death first come into the world? And a little story will be told about it. In last week, I told you about the Melanesian folk myth where the bird, the snake, got the secret of immortality and was able to slough its skin, and man lost out, and that's why man dies. That motif was carried over into the Sumerian myth. And so the serpent comes up and takes the plant of immortality away from Gilgamesh, and so he's not able to carry back immortality to Uruk. This, in the same sense, is parallel. "And the precious bones were therefore immediately scattered. Then the quail bit into them and nibbled them." And so something is, they're not left in their entirety. "And when Quetzalcoatl regained his senses, he wept. And then he said to his Nahual, 'My Nahual, how will it be?' And at once he was answered, 'How will it be? It will be undone, but let it be as it will.' And so immortality is lost. "And then he gathered and reassembled the bones and bundled them up, and then he brought them to Tamawan Chan, the land of mist and cloud, where in other mythologies the Mexicans first came from their other culture to land on the shores of Mexico. Michael Coe thinks it's somewhere around Veracruz and associates the Olmec land as the land of Tamawan Chan. "And when he arrived there, then she who is called Quilastli, she, Siwakoatl, reduced them to powder, which she even placed in a jade stone bowl, and thereupon Quetzalcoatl bled his member." So here you have, he's immolating his penis in an act of sacrificial atonement. So he has the remnants of the dead civilization, the Atlantis before, the Azatlan, as it's called in Nahual. And over this, he is trying to start up a new culture and a new civilization. And in order to inseminate it with life, he ritually bleeds into it. And so you have this pattern that I've described before from the Upper Paleolithic, where the man tries to adopt the mana and power of the feminine principle through the sacred hieroglyph of the wound. And so when Christ exposes his wound, which is cleft and opened, it's an exposure of the menstrual vulva with its mystery of life and eternal continuity and birth and death. So that this is the pattern of the magic wound that Jesus has as Avatar and Quetzalcoatl has. But in the sense that he's wounding his penis to give life to the dead, he's in a sense literally adopting the regenerative power of the feminine principle. And so the initiate has always the qualities of both male and female, and is in that sense the ultimate mystery of the shaman is the androgen. Then all the gods did penance, and they will be named herewith. Lord drawn to the water, who tills the earth, Lord issuing forth, who ferns the earth, he who falls headlong, and the sixth, who is Quetzalcoatl. And then they spoke, born of the servants of the gods, for indeed they did penance for us. Again they spoke, but what will they eat? Now that they're alive, and they're mortal, and they're dying, the basic next mystery of matter is food. And of course, food is another one of these agencies of transformation, because you take a substance, in the words of, say, Levi-Strauss, the raw and the cooked, and you either take it naturally or you transform it, and you turn grain into bread or you turn grapes into wine. But the other stage is to take it into your body and transform it into your body. So food begins to be the central sacrament of the nature of matter itself, and the way in which matter is spiritualized and turned from brute resistant matter to consciousness. But what will they eat? O gods, let food be discovered. And then the ant brought maize kernels out of the heart of Food Mountain. And again, it's these societal insects that are used as the agencies and helpers of Quetzalcoatl. In the Book of the Hopi, the myth is that in the flood, in one of the world catastrophes, the ant people take the humans down into the center of the earth, and while all hell breaks loose upon the outside surface of the earth, they're protected. And then after the world has calmed down, they're led up to the sunlight again to begin the new age. And at once Quetzalcoatl confronted the ant, asking, "Where did you find it? Tell me." But she would not tell him. Over and over he asked her, and at last she said to him, "There." And then she showed him the way, and at once Quetzalcoatl changed himself into a black ant. Then she showed him how to enter inside. Then together they dragged it out. The red ant, it seems, showed Quetzalcoatl the way. At the exit, he laid down the kerneled maize. The whole civilization is going to be based upon corn. So this is the central myth of explaining how corn came into being, how corn was domesticated, because corn is one of these plants that can't exist without us. And so the whole germinating process of corn requires culture. So corn is an artifact even in its condition. And wild corn is about this size. And so the corn that we know with the large kernels is the interaction of human society with nature. And so the fact that their civilization is based upon corn is a discussion of the mystery of symbionts, so that the whole process between man and corn is a co-evolutionary process. At the exit, he laid down the kerneled maize. Then he took it to Tamoan Chan, and then the gods chewed it. Then they laid it upon our lips so that we were made strong. Now this is a process that's fascinating for several reasons. There are some cultures where the mother will masticate the food first and then give it to the infant, and sort of like making Gerber's baby food. And so again, you have this process that sheer energy can't be taken in by people who are unprepared for it. So the mother has to masticate the food. So analogously, the gods have to digest the food for us. If we were to take it directly, it would be indigestible or it would be harmful for us. Now the interesting thing in the ways that myth gives poetic shape to what we like to, in our culture, call scientific truths, is seen in this particular passage. If you consider the relationship of, say, the Earth with the solar wind and the general proton stream coming in from the radiations of the sun, there's no way that we could take that radiation directly or we'd all be burnt out. But that radiation is absolutely essential for everything going on the planet. So all the evolutionary planet of processes on the planet depend on that stream of energy. Because of the atmosphere and the Earth's magnetic field, there's a deflection of that energy and a filtering out, so that the sheaths of energy around the Earth, literally digest the stream of the solar wind, and in digesting it, transform it back down to the living animals and men farther down on the crust of the Earth, and therefore make life possible. So you have, in a sense, the sun being seen as a god, and the Earth as another goddess, and the digestion of the solar energy and the passage on to the little children of the human beings is a phenomenon that you can look at in two different ways, either the mythopoeic way that we have here or the scientific way that we have in our own culture. But the phenomenon is pretty much one, in the sense that reality is single, and you can look upon the universe either scientifically and gain certain insights and become blind to other things, or you can look at it mythically and gain certain insights but also achieve certain blindness. So you pay your money and you take your choice. And they spoke then, what shall we do with Food Mountain? Interesting thing about Food Mountain, I remember reading a scientific article on the evolution of life, and I think the evolution of life in the ocean was precipitated by two phenomena. I think electrical discharge of lightning, which I don't know the proper word for the phenomenon by which the molecules are formed and then sink to the deeper ocean where they're protected to evolve, but also the kind of impregnation from volcanoes exploding and pouring in material into the oceans as well. So that you have this notion that the evolution of life is very complex. You get a galactic soup that's just ready for life to evolve, but it needs to be inseminated, and so a star dies and explodes and goes into supernova and inseminates in its death the atomic material for the evolution of a new solar system, and then the whole process begins to work out galactically. But then from a planetary thing, moving your scale down from the solar system to a planet, then the process begins again as lightning and volcanoes stir up the primeval soup of the ocean, and then life begins to evolve. So the notion of the chthonic mystery of the volcano of Food Mountain is one that's picked up again in many mythologies. I showed you, when we were looking at the slides of Chatalhoyuk, that they had a mural to the volcano, Hasan Dagh, from which their obsidian came. And I reminded you in that lecture of how unconsciously, when we do Hollywood B-movies of evolution, we always have these kind of volcanoes erupting and a whole period of turmoil and transformation. And it seems to be the case that in the evolution of the early Homo in Africa, in the Rift Valley, in the Omo Valley in Ethiopia, that it was a period of intense volcanic activity. So these things are fascinating, the way they continually register in the unconscious and crop up in myth. And at once Quetzalcoatl set out again, and he trussed it with cords and attempted to carry it with him, all of Food Mountain, but he could not lift it. And then Oshomoko divined with the kernels, and so too did Oshomoko's wife, Sipak Tonal, divine thereupon. Indeed, the woman is Sipak Tonal. And then Oshomoko and Sipak Tonal announced, it is Nanawatl who must break open food. Break open Food Mountain. Indeed, it has been determined. But suddenly, rain gods came forth. Blue rain gods, white rain gods, yellow rain gods, red rain gods. Then Nanawatl broke open the mountain. So again, you have the same problem, that something is solid and is useless. And it has to learn how, if there is to be life, to be broken open so that it can be a cup to become a receptacle. In the words of the poet W.B. Yeats, nothing can be whole or soul that has not been rent. And then the rain god stole the food. White, black, yellow, and red maize, beans, amaranth, sage, and argemony, all the foods were stolen. So you have the whole sense of the taking away of the food and the kind of litany of the food, which is kind of nice the way they line it up. It's almost like a kind of Homeric catalog of the ships. So what we have in this first Quetzalcoatl is Quetzalcoatl 1 and the fall of Azatlan. This is Quetzalcoatl, the god, and this is preparing the world for the new cycle and trying to take the bits and pieces of the destroyed civilizations before the flood and with the scraps locate a new culture and find the basis for the new culture with agriculture and corn and the mysteries of food. So much like Osiris, Quetzalcoatl is a culture hero, and he's a bringer of the arts of civilization to the peasant villages, and he teaches them how to farm and how not to be savages and how not to stay in one place. Now I'm going to read you from another poem cycle from the annals of Cuautitlán. In the year one reed, this is their calendar that they have, these kind of double rotating wheels of various animal images for the 20-day month and various other numbers that correspond to the 52-year cycle. And so these two circles rotate in different ways and they come together like this and move in a complex pattern. And everything is organized according to the sacred calendar. And so this whole story is told around the mystery of the calendar. And of course, Quetzalcoatl is one of the great lords of the calendar and the bringer of the calendar too, the Mexicans. In the year one reed, it is told, they say, in its time, in that year, Quetzalcoatl was born, called Topolitzin, priest, one reed, Quetzalcoatl. And his mother, they say, was named Chimalma, and they say that this was the manner in which Quetzalcoatl was placed in his mother's belly. She swallowed an emerald. Came the years, two flint, three house, four rabbit, five reed, six flint, seven house, eight rabbit, nine reed. And so the whole thing is like a litany of the change of time. So that this Quetzalcoatl is a historical figure, Topolitzin, whose name means our beloved prince. And the story, as it goes in other forms as well, is that his father was a Chichimec warlord from the north, and his mother was a conquered civilized person. And so Quetzalcoatl was a union of the two opposites. But in the apotheosis of this, they fall into the pattern of the miraculous birth of the hero and say that it was a virgin birth and that his mother swallowed an emerald. The interesting thing about telling the story of the historical Quetzalcoatl, Topolitzin, our beloved prince, is that it's told over the structure and form and liturgical patterns of another Quetzalcoatl. And so we have to almost see between Quetzalcoatl the god and Quetzalcoatl the historical figure a third and missing Quetzalcoatl, who is a mythical and legendary being. And so we almost have to infer a third in the presence of the two. What seems to be the second Quetzalcoatl who comes between this one is the great lord who comes in out of nowhere, wanders in from the east, a bearded white man, sets up wearing an ocelot cap and foam sandals on his feet, coming in from the land where the sun rises, totally unbeknownst to anyone, and teaches the villagers agriculture, the arts of civilization, jade work, feather work, and how to build great cities. And he becomes lord of a great city called Tolan. Now there's an argument among the archaeologists about this mythical Tolan. According to Laurette Sejanet, Tolan is not Tula. There was a meeting of archaeologists, Mexican and American, who decided that the mythical Tolan was Tula, a very militaristic city north of Mexico City. And she insists that no, it's Teotihuacan, the city with the great pyramid of the sun, where there is indeed the palace of the plumed serpent, and you can see the image of the snake against the wall right next to the great pyramid. Personally, I think Laurette Séjourné is right, and that the later city of Tula comes from a later militaristic period, but that the classical earlier period is associated with Teotihuacan. All the myths tell of incredible powers in a great city, and that Quetzalcoatl was the lord of a great city, and that he flourished, and the city flourished, and there was great abundance of food and metalworks and jades, and that he created, with his knowledge, the entire civilization. And everything went well, and it was a golden age in the youth of Quetzalcoatl. And then slowly there is the inevitable fall, and the fall of this Tolan begins to be confused with Tula. So we've got two places. We've got Teotihuacan and we've got Tula, another city from later on. So Teotihuacan falls, according to radiocarbon dating, at around 600 AD. Tula doesn't fall till around 1975 or so. So Quetzalcoatl sets up this magical city of Teotihuacan. It begins to be, as Séjourné says, the place where the serpent learns to fly, and the place of initiatic mysteries, the place of great pyramids. And then suddenly it's, later on, it's invaded, it's given over to the wind, burnt, and the great lord Quetzalcoatl has to leave. And the remnants of the civilization are scattered like the bones. 300 years later, when the wild tribes of the north are filtering down, there is the kind of great warlord Mishcoatl, the Milky Way lord, and he becomes the father of this Tepolotzin figure. So you have an interesting situation where Chimalna seems to be an inheritor of the indigenous great civilization of Teotihuacan, and somehow is connected to the mysteries of the dead civilization. And the warlord is the wild savage who conquers the culture. Tepolotzin himself is born of the two coming together. And remember last week where I said the nativistic leader is often the child of the union of two cultures, that Moses is Egyptian and Hebrew, that Louis Riel was Métis and Canadian, that Patrick Pearse had an English father and an Irish mother. He was a revolutionary, and that in Ireland, and that Malcolm X hated the white rapist blood in him that gave him red hair. And out of that violent collision of the opposed cultures of white and black became a prophetic personality. So that the figure of the prophet is often a person who incarnates in his own personality the violently opposed opposites that are being acted out in the historical sequence itself. So if there were to be an avatar for, say, Ireland, it would have to be a person who would be both Northern Irish and Southern Irish, that kind of thing, some sort of prophetic figure to bring peace to Ireland in a time of violence and war. So what you have is the pattern, then, that Tepolotzin is to learn the ways of his father, but he rejects the ways of his father to become a priest of the long-lost religion of the plumed serpent, which by this time is ancient history, that somehow is filtering through his mother into him. And again, you have this Oedipal pattern where the son rejects the ways of the father and tries to affirm the ways of the mother, as was the case with Louis Riel, who was a nativistic leader and sort of revolutionary in Canada, and is the case with Patrick Pearse, who rejects the ways of his father and affirms the way of his mother. So you have this kind of Oedipal mother-son situation, which, as you know, is a Neolithic pattern, is a really ancient form. So when we're dealing with the figure they're talking about, we really have to separate the two figures, and this is why Quetzalcoatl gets so confusing. This is why At the Edge of History, I say if we tried to figure out 2,000 years from now who Patrick Henry Pearse was, who thought himself to be the incarnation of Cathulain, there'd be no way that anybody could peel out layer by layer the American revolutionary Patrick Henry, the Irish revolutionary Patrick Henry Pierce, and this other mythical ancient Irish Siegfried named Cathalan. All three are compressed into the figure of the president of the Provisional Republic of Ireland in 1916. Then in the time of Nine Reed, when he reached some awareness, when he reached his ninth year, he asked for his father, saying, "What does my father resemble? May I see him? May I see his face?" Thereupon he was told, "He is dead. He is buried yonder. Go and see." Quetzalcoatl went there at once, and he opened the earth. He searched for the corpse, and he gathered the bones. Now notice how in the fugal way that myth works, the opening of the bones here is a kind of leitmotif of the earlier Quetzalcoatl, the god who went down into the underworld to get the bones and create the civilization. In a place called the Shrine of Tlilatzli, he buried them. Came the years, 10 flint, 11 house, 12 rabbit, 13 reed, 1 flint, 2 house, 3 rabbit, 4 reed, 5 flint, 6 house, 7 rabbit, 8 reed, 9 flint. It's almost like the takeoff of a rocket. 10 house. This was the year of the death of Quetzalcoatl's king, who was Huactli. For 62 years he had ruled. This was the king who did not know how to plant edible corn, nor could his subjects weave robes. As yet they dressed only in hides. As yet their food was but birds, snakes, rabbit, and deer. As yet they were homeless. Rather they wandered from place to place. Here again you get the pattern that before you have the nomadic seasonal round, and the culture hero is the bringer of the arts of civilization and staying in one place. In the year 11, rabbit, Lady Shu Papal Kui Loch Loshit Sin, it's that long, ascended the throne. Her house of thatch stood beside the square where today it is paved with stones, and they say that this lady was given the city because she was Huactli's wife. Moreover, she ably invoked the devil, Itz Papalatl, 12 reed, 13 flint, 1 house. 2 rabbit it was when Quetzalcoatl came to Tlaltzinco. There he remained 4 years and built his house of penance. And so he's seen very much as a mythical priest who withdraws from society and does endless hours of penance and meditation and solitude. There he remained 4 years and built his house of penance, his turquoise house of beams. From there he passed on to Quetzalan, so crossing the river, and in that particular place he erected a bridge that still stands, they say. 3 reed, 4 flint. In the year 5 house, the Toltecs came for Quetzalcoatl to install him as king in Tolam. And so we have the sense that he is he's a great high priest and not a king, and there's a period of instability, and they go to him to be saved from the crisis of the times, and that sort of familiar pattern of, say, Boris Godunov. The story thereof has been written elsewhere. 6 rabbit, 7 reed was the time of the Lady X's death. I won't try to recite it again. 12 years had she ruled in Cautitlan. In the year 8 flint, at the place called Palace in the Woods, Aya Coyotzin ascended the throne as Cautitlan's king. 9 house, 10 rabbit, 11 reed, 12 flint, 13 house, 1 rabbit, 2 reed. According to the tradition of Texcoco, this was the year of the death of Quetzalcoatl, prince of Tolan. But in 2 reed it was that he built his house of penance, his place of worship, his place of prayer. He, the prince, 1 reed, Quetzalcoatl, built his house as 4. A house of turquoise, a house of red shell, a house of white shell, a house of precious feathers. The 4 quadrants of the earth are made into the 4 rooms of his temple. And so you get the whole sense that the temple is the microcosm of the earth, and the architecture of the temple has to correspond to those canons. There he worshipped, did his penance, and also fasted. And even at midnight he went down to the stream, to the place called Edge of the Water, and where the water moss was. And he set thorns into his flesh on the summit of Xicoatl, and also on Huixco and on Xincoc, also on Mount Nonoqualca, and he made his thorns of jade stone. His fir boughs were quetzal plumes, and his thorns of turquoise. And so you get this whole sense that Quetzalcoatl is the initiate of great arts of civilization and jewelry and of feather works. of jadestone, of red shell, were fumed with incense. And the offerings that he sacrificed were snakes, birds, and butterflies, but never human beings. And it is related, they say, that he sent up his prayers, his supplications, into the heart of the sky, and he called out to the skirt of stars, light of day, lady of sustenance, lord of sustenance, wrapped in coal, wrapped in blood, Tla Amanak, Tlalhi Kwakhtatl. And they knew that he was crying out to the place of duality, which lies above the ninefold heavens. And so the separation of Quetzalcoatl is he goes beyond the vibratory levels of the nine lokas to go beyond to the place of duality and cosmic forces itself, the place of the god Omteotl. And he does not deal with lesser regional deities or genius loci or spirits of place, and that his religion is not a religion of indigenous peasant magic, but a religion of universal, a universal religion of a high civilization. And thus they knew, they who dwell there, that he called upon them and petitioned them most humbly and contritely. And also in his time he discovered great riches, jade stone, fine turquoise, gold, silver, red shell, white shell, plumes of quetzal, cotinga, roseate spoonbill, oropendola, trogon, and blue heron. And also he discovered cacao of various colors and cotton of various colors. And truly in his time he was a great artisan on all his works, in the blue, green, white, yellow, and red painted earthenware from which he drank and ate, and in many other things besides. And in the time that he lived, Quetzalcoatl started and began his temple and raised its serpent's pillars, but he did not finish it or complete it. And in the time that he lived, he did not show himself in public. Deep within his house he dwelled protected, and his pages guarded him at many points surrounding him. In each apartment there were pages, and his apartment was the last. And in his house were mats of jewels, mats of precious feathers, mats of gold. And his house of penance, so they say, was built as four. And it is told and related that many times during the life of Quetzalcoatl, certain sorcerers attempted to shame him into making human offerings, into sacrificing humans. But he would not consent. He would not comply because he greatly loved his subjects, who were the Toltecs. So here we begin to get the historical battle where the original religion is set up by the god Quetzalcoatl, and then the warrior class is created to protect the religion, and slowly the protectors begin to become so great that they begin to take on the quality of an independent state themselves. So it's like a body in which there are all white corpuscles, so that the agents of defense begin to be a disease itself, or a state in which the Department of Defense begins to be so large that there's no culture other than the Department of Defense. So you have a period of civil war and instability in which there is a collision between the values of the priestly theocratic class, which set up the culture, and the emerging values of the militarist class built upon the ideas of terror and human sacrifice. And the whole issue is that they are trying to instigate a rule by terror so that human sacrifice begins to be the way to appease the gods. This, of course, will become the religion later on with the Aztecs. But Quetzalcoatl will have none of this. The offerings he made were always and only snakes, birds, and butterflies. And it is related, they say, that he thereby angered the sorcerers. And so they took to mocking and taunting him. And the sorcerers asserted and willed that Quetzalcoatl be vexed and put to flight. Now notice you have the situation that Quetzalcoatl seems to be, at least by the time of Tepolitzin, a great high priest and rules by authority but not power. So he's more like a Dalai Lama kind of figure rather than a king. And the militarist class has to be more or less under the aegis of the religion. But now they're longing to rule in their own stead and to push the theocracy to the side and set up a monarchy. And so you have this whole tension between authority and power that we looked at in some ways in Gilgamesh as well. In the year one reed, Quetzalcoatl died, and they say he went to Tlalnepantla to die. Thereupon his successor, called Matlaxitl, ascended the throne and ruled in Tolan. Then they tell how Quetzalcoatl departed. It was when he refused the sorcerer's decree that he make human offerings that he sacrifice humans. Thereupon the sorcerers deliberated among themselves, they whose names were Tezcatlipoca. Now we begin to get the battle of the opposites of the two. In the same way that you had in the Egyptian myth, the battle between Set and Osiris, it now begins to be the battle between Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent, and Tezcatlipoca, which means a smoking mirror, or in more literal translation, the smoke that mirrors. So matter that gives off this dark exhalation rather than light is the principle of the evil god. And Quetzalcoatl, the matter of the serpent from the earth that goes up into the sky and becomes a bird and flies back to my father the sun, or the bird that lives only at the top of the trees in the full sunlight, is seen as the principle of the divine god. Now the interesting thing about these mirrors is that the smoke that mirrors is in a sense the smoke that shows that there is a fire and shows that there is some principle of light that's trapped in a dense, coagulated, and asphyxiating smoking fire, so that it's not a clear, happy fire. And it expresses, in a sense, the mythology of Gnosticism of the two races, that there's one race that projects, that gets caught in matter, the snake, and another race that voluntarily incarnates to rescue the other race and take it back to heaven. So the battle between these opposites is like the battle between the two races. The mirror, as an image, is fascinating because Tezcatlipoca, as you'll see in a minute, is going to seduce Quetzalcoatl with the trick of a mirror. And according to Michael Coe, these mirrors were worn on the chest by the Olmecs. They were made with such precision that even under a microscope you can't see abrasion patterns, so they don't know how they polished them. According to Marshak's article in RKO Astronomy, they are emblems of a sophisticated calendrical and astronomical system. And also, according to Coe, they might have been used to project images on the ground and burn things at a distance with hocus-pocus to impress the natives. But at any rate, they're seen as images of terror and images of magic and images of a vanished technology. They're like a detritus of an Atlantean technology, and that the one piece they've been able to carry away from the flood are these strange Olmec mirrors that are associated with black magic. Now, there is a large, about 20-ton stone down in the park at Villa Hermosa in Mexico that shows a kind of leering jaguar high priest with fancy headdress with a hole in his chest just about large enough for one of these pectoral mirrors. And in his hand is a rope. And if you follow the rope all the way around the corner to the side of this great megalith is a picture of a Maya looking dejected with the rope around his neck, obviously conquered. And he has the classical Maya nose where there's no indentation for the bridge of the nose, just forehead and nose become one. So it seems that these individuals who come in, these Olmecs, conquer these villagers and impress them with some kind of magic and are able to hold them in. And one of the instruments of their magic are these mirrors. And so this lingers on in the racial memory of the Mexicans, so that when the instrument comes forth that Tezcatlipoca uses to conquer him, it's again the smoking mirror. Iwamecatl and Toltecatl, and the names of the gods who were the sorcerers are Tezcatlipoca, Iwamecatl, and Toltecatl. He must leave his city, for we shall live here. And so now there's a fight to reverse civilization and go back to savagery. They said, let us make pulque, this kind of like tequila made from cactus, a kind of wine made from the maguey cactus. We will have him drink it to corrupt him so that he will no longer perform his sacraments. And so he'll break his vow by taking intoxicating substances. And then Tezcatlipoca said, I say we must give him his body to see. Now this is kind of interesting, where they say we must corrupt him, we must drive him out of his mind, we must get him drunk. The way to capture him is to give him his body to see. Now remember back in the Egyptian myth, the way Osiris is caught and trapped and forced to fall is by being given the coffin that just fits his body perfectly, locks him in, and then causes him to fall and to be trapped and to be hurled onto the river of time. So So Tezcatlipoca is going to do something similar, and his agency of trapping is the mirror and the body. Because the body mirrors the soul, and the body is the smoke that mirrors the soul, that has more, the body having more heat than light. But who can say how or in what manner they conspired together to do such things? Tezcatlipoca went first, carrying a two-sided mirror the size of an outstretched hand concealed in a wrapping. And when he had come to where Quetzalcoatl was, he said to the pages who guarded him, "Announce to the priest, Lord, a servant has come to show you your body, that you may see it." The pages went in and informed Quetzalcoatl, who answered, "What is this, grandfather page? What body of mine does he bring? Examine it, only then may he enter." Now here again is this way that myth is like a musical score, and something is happening here that's related to this, and there's this kind of complex contrapuntal progression going on. The fall into the body is the original kind of evolution of the soul. And then we had the fall of the antediluvian civilization Atlantis or Aztlán into the with the flood. And now we have the New Mexican civilization coming up, and we're now talking again about the fall of Quetzalcoatl. But in telling the story of the fall of Quetzalcoatl, they go back to the original story of the fall into the body and begin talking about the seduction as if it were the original means by which Lucifer or Set trapped the soul into the body and locked it into the coffin. The pages went in, but Tezcatlipoca would not let them see it. He said, "I myself will show it to the priest. Tell him." And they told him. "He refuses," they said. "He insists upon showing it to you himself." Then Quetzalcoatl said, "Let him come, grandfather." And there's this whole sense that there's a finality to this and there's a timing, and Quetzalcoatl knows he can't really resist the process. Tezcatlipoca was summoned, and he entered, greeting him, saying, "My son, priest, one reed, Quetzalcoatl, Lord, I have come to salute you and show you your body." Said Quetzalcoatl, "You have taken great pains, grandfather. From where have you come? What is this body of mine? May I see it?" He answered, "My son, Lord, priest, I am your servant, come from the slopes of Mount Nonohualca. May it please you to see your body." And thereupon he presented the mirror, saying, "Behold and envision yourself, my son. It is here in the mirror you shall appear." Now remember that other Gnostic myth that I said, where the Luciferian principle says, "Jesus, come, I want you to show you something. Here's the body. Will you just try it on? Just try it on, see how it goes." And Jesus projects into the body and then gets trapped and falls and screams in agony and can't get out, and that you have the whole sense that the soul before the evolution of the material universe is a kind of free Davic fairy lollygagging among the Empyrean and not at all determinate or evolving. And the Luciferian principle, the satanic principle, the principle of limitation, has to trap the soul and matter with this body to get the whole cycle of evolution going. And so here again, it's very much the same Gnostic pattern. And the moment he saw himself, Quetzalcoatl was filled with fear. He said, "If my subjects were to see me, would they not take flight? For the eyelids were greatly swollen, the eye sockets deeply sunk, and the face much distended all over and bilious." And he sees himself in a transformed image that's transformed downward and repulsive and full of age and infirmity. Looking into the mirror, he said, "Never shall my subjects see me. Here alone will I stay." And he tries to stay there in the temple, never to touch society at all. Then Tezcatlipoca took leave and departed and conferred with Iwemecatl in order that they might indeed deride him. Said Iwemecatl, "He, the artist, Coyotl Linahuahal, shall be the one to go." And they informed him that it would be he who must go. And so here you get the principle. The artist is now the symbol of transformation, like the bees, the wasp. But the artist is beginning to be seen as the principle of seduction, of misrepresentation, of arts as opposed to culture. Quetzalcoatl is the culture hero who brings the arts of civilization. But then as the culture evolves and art becomes separate from the sacred, then art begins to be depraved art, decadent art, and begins to be the principle of deception, very much like the arts of New York, as I've said in other kinds of things. And the artist Coyotl Lina Huajal said, "Very well, I shall go. I shall see Quetzalcoatl." He went at once, and to Quetzalcoatl he said, "My son, I say, come out. Let your subjects see you. I will dress you so that you may be seen. My grandfather, do it," he said. "This I would like to see." And the artist Coyotl Lina Huajal proceeded at once. First he made Quetzal's plumes. Now this is interesting, because if you see the murals of Bonampak, as they're reproduced in Guatemala, they have these enormous plumes surrounding the body with sort of greens and blues. And what they symbolize artistically, of course, is the aura. But with the level of initiates, of course, you can see the aura. But as the culture begins to decay, and the aura of the priest obviously begins to change dramatically, there's a need to disguise and cover it so that their real condition could not be seen. In a theocratic culture, you have, in a sense, a hierarchy where everyone is in his place according to a state of evolution. And then that state of the gods can't last, and things spin round, and everything gets scattered, and you get bad priests and good warriors and noble peasants and evil aristocrats, and the whole thing begins to be chaos and separated. So what you have with the image of the aura is a means of telling consciousness to separate those things out, but the knowledge can only be had by an initiate. When I was teaching at York University in Toronto, one of my students was involved in hypnosis and parapsychological research, and found that several of the subjects under hypnosis could see auras. And he was saying, "Wouldn't this be just great if everybody could see auras?" And I said, "Are you kidding? That's the end of democracy. Because if you've got someone says, 'What are you doing here? Back to the latrines,' there's no possible way you can have the illusion of equality if you have a system where everyone is absolutely known and pegged and registered at his level of evolution. So democracy, in a sense, made possible by a fiction. And those initiates, like the gurus or the yoganandas, who can see auras absolutely and meticulously, are always to the side of political power and don't in any way interact with the political system. So, because that's in the latter stage of a culture, the age of a Kali Yuga, the age of chaos. But in a theocratic culture, in the early days, when the culture is being formed, power and authority are coming together to form a civilization, and then you have the initiate as the initiate king, or the person who can exactly see where everyone is. So when you have the fall, the purpose of the feathers is to disguise the aura and to disguise the fact that the priests are now corrupt and that their auras are muddy brown instead of, you know, lovely blue and white and other sorts of things. And the artist Coyotl Lina Huajal proceeded at once. First he made Quetzalcoatl plumes. Then he made him his turquoise mask, taking red to color the mouth, taking yellow to lattice the forehead, and then gave him his serpent teeth, then made him his beard of Katinga and spoon-bill plumes, neatly swept back. Everything becomes artifice. Everything becomes Baroque. When he arranged Quetzalcoatl's attire in this manner, then he gave him the mirror. And he looked at himself, greatly admiring himself. And then at once, Quetzalcoatl abandoned his refuge. He leaves his inner sanctuary. He leaves his meditation. He's now being seduced out. Then the artist Coyotl Lina Huajal went to tell Iwemecatl, "I have brought Quetzalcoatl out. Now go." And Iwemecatl answered, "Very well." And then he fell in with the sorcerer called Totecatl, and together they went on their way. Soon they arrived at the place where onions are washed, where they lodged with the harvestman Mashtla, who was the keeper of the Toltec mountain. And thereupon they stewed pot herbs, tomatoes, hot peppers, young corn and beans, and this continued for several days. And as magues were found there as well, they obtained some from Mashtla, and in only 4 days they prepared and decanted the pulque, the magical liquor, like tequila. It was they who discovered the wild honeycombs, and so with honey they blended the pulque to disguise again its substance so that the potency of the alcohol will not be so apparent. Then they went then to Tolan, to the house of Quetzalcoatl, bringing all their pot herbs, their peppers, etc., also the pulque. They arrived and confronted Quetzalcoatl's guards, who refused them permission to enter. Twice, thrice, they were turned away. Indeed, they were not admitted. At last, they were asked where their home was. They replied, saying, Yonder it lies at Priest Mountain, at Toltec Mountain. As Quetzalcoatl heard this, he said, they may enter. They entered and greeted him. Also they gave him the pot herbs, and when he had eaten, they entreated him further and offered the pulque. But he said to them, no, I cannot drink it. He is vowing not to take alcohol. He's a monk. No, I abstain. Does it take away the senses? Is it fatal? They answered him, taste it with the tip of your finger. It is strong. It is newly made. Quetzalcoatl tasted it with the tip of his finger, and finding it good, said, I would drink more, grandfather, three more draughts. And they answered him, four more shall you drink. Thus they gave him even his fifth. In Mexican ritual, when you say this is the fifth draught, this for the fifth, this is the final draught that makes you drunk. This is your sacrament. When he had drunk, then they served all his pages, and each took five draughts. They made themselves utterly drunk. Again the sorcerers addressed Quetzalcoatl, my son, may it please you to sing. Here is the song you shall give us. And then Iwemecatl recited it for him. House of Quetzal, Azakuan, of Red Shell, I leave thee, Anya. And so you have the whole sense of the fall. Just as once we left the realms of the soul to descend into matter and start the process of incarnation, so now Quetzalcoatl is leaving his temple, his refuge, and moving down into the fall and abandoning the civilization so that everything is going to come apart. And Quetzalcoatl said joyously, bring me my elder sister, Quetzalpetlatl, that we may be drunk together. Now there's always the initiatic consort, and in Egypt it's the sister wife, and so you have Isis and Osiris, rulers together. Quetzalpetlatl means Quetzal butterfly, and she is the chaste sister of Quetzalcoatl, who as an initiate is not his wife but his sister, and lives with him and maintains the practice. And as Quetzalcoatl is visibly the king, she is much more withdrawn. In a sense, it's the mirror opposite of Aurobindo and the mother, where Aurobindo was withdrawn in meditation in his inner house, and the mother was the externalizing force that created the city. Now, the lovely thing about Quetzal butterfly is it's the feminine symbol of transformation. The male symbol is the serpent that learns to fly, that goes up the spinal column and becomes a bird and flies off to the sun. But the butterfly is the bird, is the worm that goes through the chrysalis and then turns into a butterfly and achieves a spiritual illumination and then flies off into the heavens and into the sunlight to live with flowers. So it's a lovely kind of feminine image of sunlight and air and flowers. But the process is the analogous process of transformation. And so Quetzalcoatl is the male image, Quetzalpetlatl the feminine image. His pages repaired to the place where she fasted, to Mount Nonahualca, saying, Quetzalpetlatl, penitent lady, my daughter, we have come to fetch you. The priest Quetzalcoatl awaits you. Go and be with him. She said, very well, grandfather page, let us go. And arriving, she seated herself next to Quetzalcoatl, whereupon she was given the pulque, four draughts, and one more, the fifth, as her portion. Then Iwemecatl and Totlecatl made both of them drunk. Probably the four and five drafts mean to drinking to the four quadrants of the Lord of the Four Quarters, and the fifth for the center. It's like the pyramid. And there is in Mexico, as in Tibet, the Lord of the Four Quarters and the Buddha of the Four Quarters, and then the Buddha of the fifth at the center. Then to Quetzalcoatl's sister, they presented a song, singing, where now is your home, my sister, my Quetzalpetlatl? Oh, it's here where you tipple, Anya, Yanya, Yayan, Yayan. Having made themselves drunk, no more did they say, we are fasting. And then they went down to the river no more. No more did they puncture themselves with thorns. Nothing more did they do at the break of day. And at dawn they were filled with remorse. Their spirits were heavy. And so what you have, he becomes drunk. He lays with his sister in incest. He violates all the rules. He's now been drunk. He's now fallen into sexuality. And so sexuality is again another image of the fall. Thereupon Quetzalcoatl said, unfortunate me. And then he raised his lament. He composed for his going away. And he sang, no more. The days will be counted no more in my house. And it shall be empty. For only beyond I awaken. From earth, from the flesh I depart. Quickly from burning and pain. Never more do I thrive. Then he sang the words of another song. She will nurse me no more, she, my mother, Anya, she of the serpent skirt, Ah, the Holy One, I, her child, alas, am weeping, Iya Yeon. And Quetzalcoatl sang, and then all were made sad, and so his pages wept then and sang, saying, No more we delight in him, him our noble one, him Quetzalcoatl. No more thy precious crown, the bleeding thorns are broken. We mourn for him, we weep alas. And the thorns are these cactus needles with which he would immolate himself for sacred penitence. And when Quetzalcoatl's pages had sung, then he spoke to them, Grandfather Page Enough, I am leaving the city, for now I depart. Give the command that a funeral urn be made. And so here again is this motif. Then quickly a funeral urn was carved, and when it was carved and finished, they placed Quetzalcoatl in it. And so here you have the sense that something is done on one level, and then you go into the urn, and it's carried out at the other levels of the lokas, or the other vibratory planes, or astral plane, or whatever language you want to use for it. But he lay only 4 days in the funeral urn. And when he felt discomfort, then he said to his pages, Enough, Grandfather Page, we will go. But everywhere bury and conceal the things we have created, the beauty, the joy, all our wealth, all of it, our treasure. This is a pattern that's in the Book of the Hopi, too, that the things of the previous culture are hidden, and so that they won't fall into the wrong hands. It's very much a pattern that's repeated by Tolkien in The Lord of the Rings, where when the Valar leave after the sinking of Numenor, they erase all of their presences on earth and retire. And his pages did so. They hid it where Quetzalcoatl's bathing place was, at the place called Edge of the Water, where the water moss was. Then Quetzalcoatl departed. He got up, got together his pages, and wept over them. And so now there's the kind of ritual progression of Quetzalcoatl to the sea, which in some of the other versions is almost like Christ's Stations of the Cross, where every place he stops, there are water, tears that fall into the rock and leave marks. There are his accompanying dwarves who become frozen to death in the passes of the mountains. And at each stage, another event marks his going. And then they set out seeking Tlan, the black land. Tlapalam, the red land. Tlatlian, the fire land. And so they're moving to the east, toward the sun. And he traveled and ventured widely, though no place was pleasing to him. Yet he reached the place he was seeking, and then again in that place he wept. He was miserable. And so in time, in the year one reed, when he'd reached the sacred shore, the celestial water, so it is told, they say, that he halted and wept, and gathered up his attire, and put on his plumes, his turquoise mask. And when he was dressed, then at once he set fire to himself. He surrendered himself to the flames. Thereafter they called it Tlatelolco, where Quetzalcoatl surrendered to the fire. And they say as he burned, his ashes arose, and all the precious birds appeared and were seen rising upward into the sky. Roseate spoonbill, cotinga, trogon, blue heron, yellow parrot, scarlet macaw, and white-fronted parrot were seen, and all the other precious birds. When the ashes were gone, then the heart of the Quetzal rose upward at once. Now that's a pun in Nahuatl, according to Beerhorst. And it means the heart of the penis arose at well, the inner center of it. So you have a kind of parallel structure where in order to create the world, he has to wound the penis and bleed on the bones of the previous culture. And now at the end of the culture he's created, there's the sense that the inner mystery of the penis rises upward and goes into transformation to become the morning star and to become the planet Venus. So you have again this kind of tantric image of the reversal of the seminal flow creating the exfoliation of the brain and illumination on high. And therefore they knew, they saw the planet, and therefore they knew he had gone to the sky, he had entered the sky. The old people say he was changed to the star that appears at dawn. Therefore they say it appeared when Quetzalcoatl died, and so they call him Lord of the House of Dawn. So the evening star appears on the horizon, and then for 8 days it's invisible, and it makes its journey as Quetzalcoatl makes his journey, and then it appears as the morning star coming out bright and shining and before the sun appears and close to the sun, so it seems like the sun going back to the father, and the father being the star of the sun. And so the Quetzalcoatl is associated with the morning star. And this is why the Mormons see Quetzalcoatl as the Christ avatar, because in the Bible it says, "I am the morning star." And so they make a whole gloss on that as an identification of the double incarnation of the Christ in the Old and New Worlds. And it is said when he died, he disappeared for 4 days. And then he dwelled in Mictlan. Here again, like Inanna's descent into the netherworld, or Christ's harrowing of hell. When Christ dies, he goes down into the other worlds and has to act out what has gone on in matter on the cross. And for 4 days also he made himself arrows. And so in 8 days he appeared, the great star. And they said it was Quetzalcoatl. And then they said he ascended his lordly throne. So he's gone through his penance, and now in his apotheosis he's become the morning star. And when he appeared, they knew also, according to sign, who he should shoot with his arrows and strike and wound. If he comes on one crocodile, so if this star appears in this time of the calendar, it's an omen for striking old men, the old women, all whomsoever. If on one jaguar, if on one deer, if on one flower, he strikes the little children. And if on one reed, he strikes at kings, all whomsoever. And even so, if he comes on one death, and if on one rain he strikes the rain, no rain will fall. This is like one of these interpolations of a kind of peasant superstition, by saying that if the planet appears at this time of the calendar, it means that such bad things are going to happen. If on one movement he strikes young men, young women, and if on one water, then drought will occur. Therefore, in each of these signs did the elders pay him their homage. Such was the life in its entirety of him who was called Quetzalcoatl. He was born in one reed, and also he died in one reed, and so it is reckoned he lived for 52 years, and so it is finished in the time, in the year, one reed. And so the poet in this version has it going on that he's ending the poem right in the time. Now what you have then is a series of Quetzalcoatls. In the other version, Quetzalcoatl comes to the edge of the sea and makes a raft of serpents and sails off to the land of Tlapalan, the land of the rising sun, where he came from. So in this version, he comes in from nowhere with an ocelot cap, a white man, bearded, wearing foam sandals, bringing the arts of civilization. He goes through his history of creating the civilization. He falls. He goes back to the shore to go back to the culture where he came from. And he gets on a raft of serpents and disappears and promises to return. The raft of serpents is both a symbol of Quetzalcoatl and historically the kind of reed boats that are made by the South Americans. So that if you have ever seen any of those, like the Voyage of the Ra with Thor Heyerdahl, they look like serpents that are intertwined to create a raft. So there's probably also a historical figure going on, a historical reference in the raft of serpents and not just snakes. What you've got then is, in the myth, is a complex kind of canon where you have the fall of the soul into matter, the fall of the fourth sun with Atlantis or Aztlan, the fall of Tolan or Teotihuacan, and then the fall of Tula with our noble prince, Tepolotzin, who goes and says, "I will return one day." And then finally, as we enter into our history, the last Quetzalcoatl with Cortez. So that Tepolotzin is driven out by the priests who institute human sacrifice. He leaves vowing to return. The calendar spins round, and at the time and the month and the day, the Quetzalcoatl is to return. Bearded men from the east are sighted off Mexico, and they come in as the agencies of revenge who out-warrior the warriors, and Cortez killed more in a day than the Aztecs ever could, and that's why they respected him so much and were terrified. So Cortez comes back as the shadow Quetzalcoatl and comes back as the historical avenging nemesis who shows the Mexicans the true meaning of war and the true meaning of civilization and utterly decimates their civilization and brings it to an end. So that the last Quetzalcoatl, the dark, demonic, and savage one, is not the real Quetzalcoatl but overlighted by Quetzalcoatl. And so you have this kind of complex fugue going on in which each Quetzalcoatl is seen with another one behind him. So you have Cortez, Tepolotzin, the Quetzalcoatl of Teotihuacan, and then the god Quetzalcoatl who's from Aztlan, who sets up the culture of South America and Mexico. Now, according to prophecy, the next Quetzalcoatl will come somewhere around 1987. So you can wait the second coming.